Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll look into a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with the death today of former British Prime Minister Margaret Thatcher and analyse her influence in championing an ideology based on individual liberty and market-based reforms that has come to dominate Anglo-American policy debates today. Historian Daniel Stedman Jones, the author of Masters of the Universe, Hayek, Friedman, and the Birth of Neoliberal Politics, joins us. Then we'll examine the case of the American jihadist who fought with the Syrian rebels, Eric Haroun, who today appeared in federal court charged with conspiracy to use a weapon of mass destruction outside the United States. Robert Young Pelton, the publisher of Dangerous Magazine, who interviewed Haroun before his arrest by the FBI, joins us to discuss the strange story of a hard-drinking, womanizing American army vet accused of consorting with Islamic fundamentalist Al-Qaeda terrorists. Pelton has an article at Foreign Policy, A Weapon of Minor Destruction, How Eric Haroun, the American Jihadist in Syria, Was Duped by the FBI into Incriminating Himself. Then finally, we'll speak with Amitai Etzioni, the director of the Institute for Communitarian Policy Studies at George Washington University, about his article at Salon.com, How Conservatives Still Run America Despite Losing Elections. We will look into the roots of how the will of the majority is thwarted by determined and well-funded minorities, and explore why the majority Democrats allow themselves to be bullied by the minority Republicans into compromising or caving. Joining us now is Daniel Stedman Jones, author of the new book Masters of the Universe, Hayek, Friedman, and the Birth of Neoliberal Politics. He is a barrister in London and has worked as a policy advisor for the New Opportunities Fund and as a researcher for Demos. Welcome to Background Briefing, Daniel Stedman Jones.
Good evening.
And obviously, the death of Margaret Thatcher, who came into power in 1979 and left in 1990, has been tied into the Reagan era, in as much as both Reagan and Thatcher were a sort of a team, if you will, in many ways. But I take it in England there's a mixed message. The miners up in Yorkshire aren't shedding too many tears. And who are shedding tears for her in terms of the other side of the those who support her?
That's absolutely right, Ian. I think in England the legacy of Margaret Thatcher and her policies is very mixed. In America, I think you probably best remember Margaret Thatcher as the fellow struggler with Reagan in the Cold War against Soviet communism and as Ronald Reagan's staunchest ally. In England, we have a slightly different perspective, but I don't think it's just a perspective that English people should have. I think it's also a perspective that Americans and the wider world should also bear in mind when thinking about Thatcher, and that is the legacy of her neoliberal politics.
Well, in many ways, wasn't she ahead of Reagan in that sense? I mean, I know the miners' strike was in 84 to 85, and when Reagan, when he came in on his first day, he sacked the air traffic control union members and destroyed that union. So to that extent, they seem to have quite a bit in common, but she only preceded him by a year. But do you think that who influenced who, in other words?
That's absolutely right. She came into power 18 months before Reagan, and in that sense, she was definitely a trailblazer, and the Reagan administration certainly looked to her as a fellow traveler after they came to power. But you mentioned the air traffic controllers. That's a very interesting point. I conducted various interviews with former colleagues of Margaret Thatcher for the book, and they all mentioned the air traffic controllers strike in 1981 as a key moment that they drew strength from in their own battles with the miners when they were trying to face down the trade unions in Britain. And it also raises, actually, the miners' strike raises a very oft-missed element in Margaret Thatcher's political personality, which was that she was, as well as being ideologically strident, very pragmatic. So she, in fact, waited for the right moment to have the confrontation with the miners in 1984. She didn't pick the first possible chance to have a fight, as it were. Instead, she stockpiled coal, and she waited until until she felt that the government could win the strike against the miners. And in all of that, as I say, she very much drew strength from Ronald Reagan's own struggles with the air traffic controllers and drew inspiration from that.
Well, of course, the difference was that the air traffic controllers was a very small union, and it didn't really divide America in the way. And frankly, in America, the unions are so weak. They've been getting weaker by the decades. Now they're down to about 6 to 7% of the private workforce is unionized. But the struggle with the miners, it went beyond just it really divided the whole country, didn't it?
You're absolutely right, Ian. I mean, obviously, in America, that the unions were really seriously, fundamentally weakened, arguably in the late 40s, obviously. Whereas in Britain, the unions had really come to dominate the political scene in the 1970s. And whatever one's political views, certainly there had been a whole series of strikes, first in the Conservative government of Edward Heath in the early 70s, but then most famously just before Margaret Thatcher won the election in what was called the Winter of Discontent in 1978-79. And that really did mark a shift, I think, in British public opinion, because it was the unions had been up to that point relatively popular, and as you mentioned, in Britain the population of unionised workers was much higher. A significant majority of workers were unionised. But in the Winter of Discontent, there were a whole series of strikes across all different sectors, which swept the Labour government out of power, really. And so, again, it's just worth noting that Margaret Thatcher didn't immediately strike, as it were, against the unions in 1979, 1980 or 1981. She waited until what she saw was the right moment, when she could actually defeat the miners. And you're also right to point to the fact that this did divide the country very, very violently. And she actually referred to the miners as the enemy within. Which, of course, was very inflammatory language to use about a class of British subjects. So it was a long, bitter, and violent struggle, which, of course, in the end, she managed to win.
Again, I'm speaking with Daniel Stedman-Jones, author of the new book Master of the Universe, Hayek, Friedman, and the Birth of Neoliberal Politics. He is a barrister in London and has worked as a policy advisor for the New Opportunities Fund and as a researcher for Demos. And we're talking about the death today of Margaret Thatcher and her legacy. And I take it that her legacy really is what's happening today, is it not? You have a Conservative government practicing her policies of austerity, belt tightening, no free lunch, and it's a mess.
Well, I think that's right. Certainly, both political parties in Britain still define themselves really in relation to many of the debates really that Margaret Thatcher had in the 1980s, and I think that at the moment the austerity policies being pursued by the Cameron government really do have a parallel in the early 1980s policies pursued by Thatcher when she embarked on a monetarist economic policy when she first entered power, and in fact within a few months Britain was mired in recession much as it is today. So it's certainly the case that there are parallels in the current government's policy with what went on in the early 1980s. And, of course, one of her most important legacies, depending on your political views, this is a good or a bad thing, but she transformed British politics to the extent that the Labour Party would never be the same. I mean, in America, I think you would refer to the post-war period as the sort of New Deal order. Well, we had an equivalent in Britain, and it's certainly true that Margaret Thatcher and her policies brought that post-war consensus, as we call it in Britain, to an end, and actually instituted a new radical form of market fundamentalism to its critics, which has been in place ever since.
Well, didn't she say, Margaret Thatcher, that Tony Blair, New Labour were her legacy?
Absolutely, absolutely, she did. And, of course, you know, more liberal in the American sense or progressive critics of Tony Blair certainly have described Tony Blair as a Tory in disguise or a watered-down version of Margaret Thatcher. And it's also true that he didn't, a bit like Bill Clinton, again, in the American context, he didn't challenge fundamental elements of the economic policies that were instituted under both Thatcher in Britain and Reagan in the United States, but rather accommodated the Labour Party to them. So, for example, the emphasis was on developing the financial sector in Britain. The City of London is obviously one of our largest and most successful exports, and the Labour Party in the 2000s under Blair certainly relied heavily on that financial sector for tax revenue, ultimately to its cost once the financial crisis hit in 2007 and 2008.
Well, I guess there are parallels again with Bill Clinton in terms of the financialization of the economy and the growth of the power of Wall Street and the ruin that they brought. After all, Ronald Reagan appointed Alan Greenspan as the chairman of the Fed, and then he suddenly flooded this cheap money, and instead of the American middle class and working Americans getting wages commensurate with their standard of living, they were encouraged to get into credit as opposed to because wages have basically been flat since the late 70s. And then Greenspan, of course, stayed on and became Clinton's guru, and he basically engineered the great Clinton boom, which, you know, they got rid of Glass-Steagall, et cetera, and Wall Street got everything they wanted. And then, you know, by the end of the Bush administration, the whole thing blew up. So am I correct in suggesting that the financialization of the economies in both cases, there's a mirror?
I think you are absolutely right to suggest that. And I think it's very useful to think of the Greenspan era. Actually, I mean, it was the high point of a faith in free markets, which absolutely was entrenched first during the 1980s under Thatcher and Reagan, and that faith in the automatic correcting mechanism, if you like, of the market was obviously the fatal flaw that Greenspan was eventually forced to admit after 2008. And certainly in Britain, the economic story was even more obviously wrong, in the sense that to the extent that there was a monetarist argument, it was the argument that inflation would be reduced. Now, arguably, Greenspan did reduce inflation over a long period, and Paul Volcker had done before him. In Britain, in fact, during the 1980s, when Thatcher was in power, you have two big recessions, one in the early 80s and one at the end of her period in office, the end of the 80s and into the early 90s, where, in fact, you still have very, very, very high inflation. So even on their own terms, on monetarist terms, if you like, Thatcher's economic policies did not work. And of course, she did decimate the productive sectors of the economy without thinking about what might be put in place to replace those sectors. And so, you know, that has had a lasting legacy in Britain, because we have whole communities that lost, to go back to your original point about the miners' strike, which lost their ability to survive, really, by virtue of a lack of governmental investment and support.
So, in other words, England didn't have the Clinton boom years, which, of course, were the beginning of the bubble being inflated, which later burst in 2008 under George W. Bush. So you didn't even have that interregnum, right?
Well, it's slightly... No, I mean, certainly there was no boom under Thatcher. There was a brief period of growth in the middle of the 1980s, which then obviously collapsed into another recession at the end of the 80s. Mm. But you did have a boom, unlike in America, actually, in the 2000s, under Blair and Brown, and that really is the parallel
with the Clinton years,
and also in the British context as well as America, you get exactly the same financial deregulation under Blair and Gordon Brown, who succeeded Blair, which was followed by Clinton and subsequently under the Bush. The George W. Bush administration too. So in both Britain and America in the 1990s and 2000s, you get a continuation really of the financial deregulation, which began during the 1980s under both Thatcher and Reagan. And clearly those deregulation policies were one of the biggest causes of the crisis in 2008.
And Daniel Stedman-Jones, again, author of the new book, Masters of the Universe, Hayek, Friedman, and the Birth of Neoliberal Politics. Paul Kenny, the General Secretary of the GMB Union in the UK, speaking of Margaret Thatcher today, said her legacy involves the destruction of communities, the elevation of personal greed over social values, and legitimizing the exploitation of the weak by the strong. She did say, infamously, that there's no such thing as society. What was the context for that comment, and what did she mean?
That's an interesting point that you raised there, because Thatcher was, of course, similar to Reagan, was very, very influenced by her upbringing, and she had a sort of somewhat contradictory vision of a mixture of traditional conservatism, really, that was born of her upbringing as a grocer's daughter in the small town in Lincolnshire of Grantham, and those values really were very similar to kind of Victorian values of individual initiative and personal responsibility on the one hand, and the family and individuals being the most important units for the moral and the potential successful economic fiber of the nation, if you like, on the one hand. But then on the other hand, she had, of course, these very radical policies in terms of free market ideas, which were destructive of many of those older values that she held very close to her heart. And so when she was speaking about there not being any such thing as society, rather there were individuals and families, I think she was referring back to that upbringing as a small shopkeeper's daughter in a small town in the middle of England.
Well, it's sort of interesting that her predecessor was also the grocer's son, was he not, Edward Heath? But he proved to have a little more compassion. At least I seem to recall in his later years, he wasn't quite as rigid as she was.
You're absolutely right. Again, Ted Heath was a much more centrist figure. He was a supporter of the unions, and I mean, partly a product of the time, I suppose, too. But certainly, Edward Heath believed that government was a good thing, and government could do good things. He wanted it to be properly limited, but he was also someone who saw its use and utility. And in that sense, he was probably quite similar to Nixon. And again, this was something that that certainly Thatcher was to oppose very strongly. But she came to it partly by accident, because in 1975, when she first replaced Heath, she was not a fully formed radical. What she was someone who followed her instincts and followed her instinct, as I've said, in terms of these traditional conservative beliefs. But they became allies to this radical free market ideas and the neoliberal ideas, which came from places like the Chicago School and Milton Friedman, who was articulating his ideas in the United States. So it's quite an interesting mixture and quite an interesting development.
And it's quite ironic in the end that it was her own party that did her in.
Absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely. Well, you know, in the end, she pushed this poll tax, which was a flat property tax for everyone in the United Kingdom, and that proved so unpopular that it led to riots. And this really did make even the Conservatives in her own party start to take notice that maybe she was becoming more of a liability than she had been before.
Well, Daniel Stedman-Jones, I thank you so much for joining us here today.
Thank you very much. It's been a pleasure to be on the show.
Again, I've been speaking with Daniel Stedman-Jones, who's author of the new book, Masters of the Universe, Hayek, Friedman, and the Birth of Neoliberal Politics. He is a barrister in London and has worked as a policy advisor for the New Opportunities Fund and as a researcher for Demos. We're going to take a brief station break and be back talking about how the American jihadi got framed certainly done in by the FBI.
Cottage small beside a field of grain.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Robert Young-Pelton, an author, filmmaker, journalist, and explorer. He is the publisher of Dangerous Magazine and has a first-hand perspective on the war on terror from direct contact with the world's most infamous jihadi, rebel, and insurgent groups. His books include The World's Most Dangerous Places, Come Back Alive, Three Worlds Gone Mad, License to Kill, Hired Guns in the War on Terror, and his autobiography, The Adventurist. He has an article at Foreign Policy, A Weapon of Minor Destruction, How Eric Haroun, the American jihadist in Syria, was duped by the FBI into incriminating himself. Welcome to Background Briefing, Robert Young-Pelton.
Hey, Ian, how you doing?
Well, I'm doing better than Eric Haroun is. He appeared in court in Virginia today, in federal court, and he was not granted bail, and he is being held over for trial. And I take it that according to the title of your article in Foreign Policy, the FBI duped him into incriminating himself.
Yeah, it's a fascinating story. I'm doing a new magazine called DangerousMagazine.com, and we were doing something on Syria, and we were basically finding odd and unusual people who are in Syria, sort of, you know, journalists, war tourists, and we came across Eric, and I interviewed him, and he had a very strange tale to tell. The main contention here is that he had a weapon of mass destruction, and the FBI talked to him when he went to the consulate, and through his constant, I guess, willing overtures, he explained to them that he was with a group called al-Nusra, which was declared a terrorist group, and he did have an RPG, and he fired it. And then they realized that they couldn't actually charge him over there, so they went to his parents and his sister, and they said, oh, we've got to get Eric back here immediately because there's a hit out on him. How can we get him home? And his dad said, well, give him a free ticket. He always loves a free ticket. So the FBI bought him a ticket, and when he landed in Dulles, they made him repeat his story again on American soil and then arrested him for having an WMD.
And there's a law against having how is a rocket-propelled grenade a WMD, and why is the law written in such a way that he used it outside of the United States? I would think it would be a far more worse crime to use it inside the United States.
It's a fascinating law because it's ever-changing, and of course it's a very wide net. So WMDs used to be NBCs, nuclear, biological, chemical. And those laws were written, you know, back in the 80s when the Russians were trying to move nuclear materials or the Chinese had, you know, chemical weapons. After 9/11, they realized that an aircraft or even a propane canister could be a WMD. And then they basically wrote up anything that is indiscriminate. In other words, an RPG can be fired at an aircraft. It can be fired at a building that has indiscriminate victims. So it became a WMD. Now, here's the irony. Right now, the U.S. is supplying RPGs with training to Syrian rebels to be used against Assad. So it's kind of mind-boggling that the FBI would invest this much energy in making themselves look like fools.
Well, why did they want to get this guy some kind of trophy? He sounds like a complete idiot. I mean, he was with a more secular group. This is his excuse, I understand, from your article at Foreign Policy, Robert Young Pelton, A Weapon of Minor Destruction, How Eric Haroun, the American Jihadist in Syria, was duped by the FBI into incriminating himself. He was with this more secular group, and here he is, a hard-drinking, womanizing American army vet who hadn't served abroad. He was in the stateside driving a truck and had an accident, right? And he was on disability. And he then gets stranded in a town, I think, in Syria. And the only people around are the al-Nusra people. And why they didn't shoot him on the spot, I don't know, because he's obviously, you know, not one of them. And he certainly is not pious and an Islamist. He's photographed hanging out with these guys in the back of a truck.
No, it is the plot for a sitcom, because Eric Haroun likes the ladies. He likes to drink. He likes to party. He's got videos on his Facebook of him driving 120 miles an hour on the Autobahn, driving around Beirut completely drunk with five friends, picking up the sunroof. He is in no way, shape, or form a fundamentalist, but he did post on his Facebook site, you know, an only good Zionist is a dead Zionist, and he seems to have an aversion against Israel. Now, he was involved in the Arab Spring. He went over there, like many people did, and waved the flag, and apparently he got arrested. He does like to hang out in Beirut, so he saved his money when he worked at the mortgage company. And on his last trip over there, he met some friends, and they decided to get into Syria and try to fight. So he did join the Free Syrian Army. But the very first offensive he was on was a joint operation with al-Nusra. Al-Nusra is the tail end of what used to be al-Qaeda in Iraq, which we were told was destroyed, but reconstituted itself in Syria. He escaped, or he basically had to escape with the al-Nusra on the back of a truck. They held him captive, and then after listening to his story, they allowed him to go out fighting, and apparently he saved some people, and they thought he was a great hero. But he got the hell out of there. He was only in there for a month. And his passport was destroyed. So when he was talking, when he was out, he started talking to the media, and he talked to the Times of Israel, who wrote a story about him being a fundamentalist and, you know, essentially the stereotype of somebody that goes to fight a war because he believes in Islam and Wahhabism. And he freaked out. And when I talked to him, he would say, I'm going to hire a lawyer to sue those people. And was terrified that he might be on a no-fly list. And he had just come back from an interview with the embassy in which he went to get his passport. When he went to the embassy, that article written by Times of Israel and Fox News was actually on the desk of the FBI guy.
This is in the U.S. embassy in Istanbul, right?
Istanbul. Yeah, it's actually a consulate. But So a CIA lady came from downstairs and played bad cop and told him how much trouble he was in, and the FBI played good cop. But they both told him that it was against the law to fight in Syria. And so when he was talking to me, he basically said, hey, if it's against the law, I'm not going to fight. But, I mean, they should give me a medal because I'm shooting the same guys that they're trying to kill. So his moral perspective was correct, but the technicality was incorrect. So at some point, somebody in the consulate decided that they would make an example of him and charge him with this crime. But they couldn't do anything in Turkey because it's not U.S. soil. So they had to trick him into getting back to the U.S. and then incriminating himself. And right now he's in lockdown. He's only allowed out 2 hours a day in solitary confinement in Alexandria.
So is it the fact that he's sort of anti-Israel and anti-Zionist, and did that do him in? I mean, he's just an idiot. I mean, I guess there's no law against being stupid, is there?
No, and the problem is that he was flagged by a guy who goes under the alias of Ibn Ben Zion, who works for the Times of Israel. His Facebook page was penetrated. They had photos posted of his Facebook page before the FBI did a subpoena on March 30th. And then his video was picked up by Memory, which is a charity or a nonprofit run by a former Israeli intelligence colonel.
That's M-E-M-R-I, right? M-E-M-R-I spelled.
Yeah, correct.
Not
Middle Eastern. Yeah.
Go ahead.
But the point is that immediately flagged them as a potential terrorist. And, of course, putting videos of yourself on YouTube talking about shooting down helicopters is going to get your attention anyway. So, yes, he did everything he could. Like the accident, I call him the Occidental terrorist because he's from the West. He's clueless. He had no idea who he was fighting with. And then he only learned from reading media reports about what he did, how serious his predicament was.
So why are they throwing the book at the guy? I mean, what are they going? What's the FBI get out of this? I mean, there's some serious things that they should be doing.
The same reason that cops give out tickets in the carpool lane. You know, it's easy pickings. It gets a lot of headlines. It looks like you copped a terrorist. But I think this will turn out to be more embarrassing than anything else because our support for Syria is on the rebel side. We don't support the government of Syria, and we're providing, I think it's $12 million last time I saw, in direct support and a lot in covert support to overthrow the government of Bashar Assad. So he's baffled. His father is mystified as to why he's a criminal.
So what is the reason that they, had he not been as loopy as he appears to be and just sort of having a good time, and I don't know, you know, obviously you don't need too many qualifications as a soldier to join this Free Syrian Army because most of them are just citizens, right, who've never...
Right, they give you a month of training. It costs $100 to get into Syria. You go in, you sign up. They give you a month of training if you're like a shoemaker or a bookkeeper, and then they put you out in the front lines. It's not technically against the law to fight overseas. There is a mercenary act, but no one's been charged under it. What's against the law was consorting or supporting al-Nusra, which is considered a franchise of al-Qaeda, and then also using or firing a weapon of mass destruction. And these are very, very shaded technicalities.
Well, but what I was going to suggest is that if the guy wasn't so out of it, he would have, you know, the FBI and the CIA might want to have recruited the guy. But was is he his own worst enemy?
Yeah, because, you know, I've gone in with other American jihadis that went to fight, and it's very secretive. I mean, they basically hide you in a trunk. You wear civilian clothing. There's no photographs. There's no record, unless you're killed, of course. Remember, I found John Walker Lynn, who was told to pretend he was Irish.
So that's the American Taliban in Afghanistan from the beginning of the first Afghan war, or the beginning of the Afghan war.
But he was told by bin Laden's people to say that he was Irish if he was captured so that it wouldn't draw attention to the fact that he was American. When he was interrogated, he said nothing. If you remember the famous video of Mike Spann and Dave Tyson trying to interrogate John Walker Lynn, he said nothing. So the bottom line is that most Americans that fight overseas don't brag about it on their Facebook page.
Well, it's difficult to know exactly what this guy did. I mean, you know, all he did was fire an RPG. Is that about it? Although he rescued a couple of people, you said?
There's some video I have of him actually being under attack. I don't see him actually fighting. There's a lot of pictures of him posing. You know, like he'll hold an RPG and then his friend will hold the RPG. He'll hold an AK. You know, Eric is prone to exaggeration. His father said that he's kind of a BSer. You know, he likes to charm the ladies and impress his friends. So I don't know if what he told the FBI was entirely truthful or whether it was fabricated or whether it was dead, you know, centered truth. But he has a penchant for exaggeration from reading his Facebook page. And he's also disabled because he has a plate in his head. And his father said that affected his thinking and his mood, so he may be bipolar. There's a bunch of things that may or may not come out in the trial.
And he's got a plate in his head because when he was in the Army stateside, he crashed a truck, right?
Right. He was never deployed overseas. He worked in a bridge unit, and he had an accident. And his father said he cried when he was told he could no longer serve in the military after his accident. So he's been a bit of a lost soul ever since, maybe kind of a Walter Mitty. Mm-hmm. You know, he likes to go to these places and take pictures of himself, which is very unusual for someone that was hardcore. If you were hardcore, you wouldn't have a photograph of you anywhere.
Sure. Well, I thank you for joining us, filling us in on this odd story, you know, which, of course, is getting a lot of press coverage about the American jihadi, and he's been denied bail, and now he's facing trial. But I guess what you're saying is that it may all, and when it all comes out in the trial, it may not look as bad as...
Yeah, and keep in mind, there's ramifications for things like drone strikes against American citizens and entrapment. I mean, there's a whole bunch of things that will come out during the trial that should make every American slightly nervous.
about how we capture terrorists.
Well, Robert Young-Pelton, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Thank you, Ian.
Again, I've been speaking with Robert Young-Pelton, who's an author, filmmaker, journalist, and explorer. He's the publisher of Dangerous Magazine and has a first-hand perspective on the war on terror from direct contact with the world's most infamous jihadi, rebel, and insurgent groups. His books include The World's Most Dangerous Places, Come Back Alive, Three Worlds Gone Mad, License to Kill, Hired Guns, and The War on Terror, and his autobiography, The Adventurist. He has an article at Foreign Policy, A Weapon of Minded Destruction, How Eric Haroun, the American Jihadist in Syria, was duped by the FBI into incriminating himself. We're going to take a brief station break and be back talking about how conservatives still run America despite losing elections. Don't want to be an American idiot. Don't want a nation under the new media. And can you hear the sound of hysteria? The subliminal mind fuck America.
Senators, congressmen, please heed the call. Don't stand in the doorway, don't block up the hall. For he that gets hurt will be he who has stalled. The battle outside raging will soon shake your windows and rattle your walls. For the times, they are a-changing.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Amitai Etzioni, who's a university professor and professor of international affairs and director of the Institute for Communitarian Policy Studies at George Washington University. He served as a senior advisor to the White House from 1979 to 1980, and in 1990 he founded the Communitarian Network, a not-for-profit, nonpartisan organization dedicated to shoring up the moral, social, and political foundations of society. Dr. Etzioni is the author of 24 books, including The New Golden Rule, The Spirit of Community, and The Moral Dimension, Towards a New Economics. His most recent books are My Brother's Keeper, A Memoir and a Message, From Empire to Community, A New Approach to International Relations, and How Patriotic is the Patriot Act. He has an article at Salon.com, How Conservatives Still Run America Despite Losing Elections. Welcome to Background Briefing, Amitai Etzioni.
Thank you very much for having me again.
And today in the New York Times, we learned that Senator Max Baucus, 28 of his former aides are now lobbying for various lobbying tax policy for various telecommunications businesses, blue chip clients like oil companies, retailer and financial firms. And of course, Max Baucus is a key Democratic senator from Montana. He was the man largely given the point man on the first thing that Obama did when he came in with a substantial majority. He won the presidency in 2008 by incredible margins that hadn't been seen for a long time. The Democrats controlled the House and the Senate, and the biggest signature item was the health care bill that really ended up in the lap of Max Baucus and was compromised to death. And it's always been a mystery to me, Amitai Etzioni, why at that moment when Obama had all of that energy, why he wasn't able to get a lot done and had the wind at his back. And paradoxically, of course, that was the same moment that the Tea Party was born, out of the outrage over Wall Street. But instead of expressing outrage over the Wall Street and galvanizing populism on the left, it looks like Obama handed a lot of it to Max Baucus.
Well, that's very, very true. You already raised three different issues. All are crucial to this general point we are making, that while the Republicans as a party may not doing well, because they are about at least a third of the elected Democrats are conservatives and act and vote like Republicans, in effect, the conservatives get their way even when the Republican Party does not. It sounds odd, but if you think about it, if you take all the Republicans and add a third of the Democrats, their agenda will win most times. So one reason are the lobbies. It's true, there are lobbies of all kinds. The labor unions also a lobby, and so do the teachers. But by and large, the business lobbies have much deeper pockets, are much more organized, and there are many more of them. So when it comes to campaign contributions, which very, very often swing Congress, especially after the Supreme Court decision, which allows unlimited donation by corporations, we have the lobbying tilts the system into a conservative direction. The second, you talked about the energy and the behind President Obama when he was elected. But we must understand the difference between people voting once every 4 years or 2 years and what happens between election days. And there, when you need an act of Congress, you cannot simply say, I got 50X percent of the public vote, therefore you have to follow me. Members of Congress obviously follow their own constituency. So let me give you a quick example so they won't be so abstract. What happened now is this very meager, nebbish gun control bill. There were three little items which together wouldn't amount to much, but I agree they're better than nothing. So the first thing, Senator Reid, the leading senator for the Democrats, removed the ban on assault rifles from the bill so it wouldn't even come up for vote and discuss. Why? Because he found out that out of the 53 Democratic senators, the majority, 15 of them would not support it because they come from red states, from conservative states. So you had 40 relatively progressive senators for the gun bill, 60 the Republicans plus 15 Democrats against it. And I can give you one example or the other. All have the same structure, that if you count noses as Democrats or Republicans, you think the Democrats should have it. If you count them by the kind of lobbying and politics they represent, unfortunately, the conservatives have it, not every time, most times.
Well, actually, I don't blame you for being a little bit confused by my first question, Amitai Etzioni, because I got a little confused myself there. The first thing that Obama did was the stimulus, and a lot of people like Krugman and others were saying it's not big enough, and that's what Max Baucus was in charge of. It wasn't the health care. That was Ben Nelson, who another one of these conservative Democrats who ended up watering that down. But, you know, the argument is that had Obama not caved in to the Republicans' demand to make – a third of the stimulus tax breaks, and made a bigger stimulus, the economy would have recovered long ago, and we wouldn't he wouldn't be in the mess he's in today.
It's a combination of the factors you mentioned, plus the fact that the president, in his whistle, in his guts, does not like to confront. He really has his own negotiation style, where he starts by giving you half of what you possibly could ask for, just to show you that he means well, he's a nice guy. Then he makes some more concessions, and then he begins negotiations. And let me go back to the example you gave. If you look back at what Larry Summers, who was at that time the Secretary of the Treasury, was working with the president, he told the president, you should not go for the real big stimulus package, because the Congress will not accept it, and you will have to fight. So even before they start talking to Congress, they already cut it. Then you correct, of course, Senator Nelson, a conservative Democrat, voted it down some more, and we ended up in the mess we are. But let's jump back to health care. Before anything happened, President Obama called the insurance companies and promised them not to put single-payer the preferred liberal option, even on the table, because he was told that unless he mollifies the insurance companies, he will end up like Hillary. He won't have a chance to get a bill at all. The second people he called in was Big Pharma, the pharmaceutical industries, and promised them that the bill will not include the right of Medicare to negotiate for drug prices or to import drugs from other countries in which they have much lower costs. So from the very beginning, the president also has not shown the kind of backbone, a little stature, a little strength, a little leadership. So he gives away half the shop, then the conservative Democrats finish the job.
So is there something else at play here, though, Amitai Etzioni, again, university professor and professor of international affairs and director of the Institute for Communitarian Policy Studies at George Washington University, and he has an article at Salon.com, How Conservatives Still Run America Despite Losing Elections. Now, Harry Reid, who you mentioned, has certainly compromised on the very modest gun control or gun safety bill that is being taken up this week, and we're not even sure which of the bills will be taken up, but certainly the assault weapon bans have already been preemptively stripped out. It looks like he got snookered by Mitch McConnell. The younger Democrats in the Senate were furious about this usurpation of power by the Republicans, insisting on a 60-vote threshold on almost all bills, the filibuster threshold. Rather than go what they call the nuclear option, Reid made a deal with Mitch McConnell and promptly got completely snookered. And the Republicans just are not allowing any of the judicial nominations, the key ones, to go through, and many of the appointments to the executive branch and the cabinet appointments they've held up, as we know, with the CIA director and the Secretary of Defense, and others have been submitted, having to fill out thousands of pages of questionnaires. None of this has happened before. The minority party is incredibly aggressive, and somehow or other, it's able to bully the majority into compromising or caving. So what explains that? Because, you know,
it's not a minority party. If you're a minority party, you mean the Republicans.
Right. I know.
You need to think about is what I call a conservative party.
Right.
The Republicans have allies among some of the Democrats who vote with them. The liberals don't have any Republicans who vote with them. The minority party are the liberal Democrats. Here another quick, very, very telling, simple, straightforward example. During the inaugural speech, the president focused on one issue. He really gave it more play than anything else, and that was climate protection. That's what he ran up the flagpole. You haven't heard a thing about it since. Why? Because immediately after the inaugural speech, the conservative Democrats from coal states came and said, oh, no, we're not going to support that. They joined the Republicans and made it very clear they're not going to, and that's the end of climate improvement for the next 4 years. He may do some an executive order. So because one of the many reasons, the other reason, of course, we don't read the politics right. You can't start changing it unless you start getting it right. What the map is like. The map is the minority party Republicans, together with conservative Democrats, make a majority. Now, let me jump one more thing, which is, I appreciate you mentioned the article in the Salon. One other thing happens, we pay a lot of attention, as you should, to the laws which are being enacted. But there's something happening where we are not paying a lot of attention. And that is why we're all asking, did they pass a ban on assault rifles? Did they pass a ban on high-capacity magazines and improved background checks? They did act. They passed 4 corrections to the regulations, which makes it next to impossible to enforce these laws. So the Conservative Party, the Republicans plus Democrats, and you can see the details on this little article I did. For instance, they will not allow the Bureau of Fire and Microarms, which is in charge of enforcing the law, to use a computer. The gun checks will have to be done on pieces of paper. Can you imagine how that sets back the enforcement of that law? The information collected can be kept only for 24 hours. And there are two other things like that. They didn't allow the Bureau to have a director. When the Bureau doesn't have a director, it gets very set back, very hobbled. So unless we start to get correctly the lay of the land, we will not be able to change it.
Well, I think your point's definitely well taken about that, that there's a Conservative Party and a small Liberal Party of Liberal Democrats, and that the so-called centrist Democrats more often than not do vote with the Republicans, picking on issues involving guns, because the conventional wisdom is they're in red states and the NRA has a lot of sway. And in coal states, as you mentioned, Manchin, for example, is both for guns and for coal, West Virginia. But on the judicial nominees, they had the majority vote. The Democrats had the majority vote. They just couldn't get around the filibuster. And that's the real issue, isn't it? You know,
you're absolutely right. The Republicans or Conservative Party succeeded changing the rules of the game in addition to the substantive specific changes they made. They also, you're right, the filibuster used to be something relatively rare, used for very special occasion, and requires you to actually filibuster. They turned it into a practical veto. They did other changes. You used to be able to make recess appointments. If you couldn't get somebody through the regular process, the president could, while Congress was not in session, make recess appointments, and in this way somehow get something done. Well, they now found a little gimmick. They never out of session. So they don't allow any more Congress to take a break. They mechanically, technically keep Congress open at all times. And this way, they succeeded in killing recess appointments. Many other changes, of course. The most important one is the one made by the Roberts Court, the Citizens United, which really is opening the floodgates to corporate money into the election. So we really are not in a good place. By the way, while we talk about campaign financing, let me make a prediction. I studied that years ago when PACs first became legal. It takes a while before the corporations catch on. When the law has changed, none of the corporations likes to be the first to jump in to do things which until last year were considered illegal and kind of a little tainted. And so they let others take the lead. But when they see that more and more corporations jump in, then they go full hog. These last elections, corporations really did not make very large contributions yet. Wait to see the next election. Look, the total cost of the election last time for all concerns, all parties, was about $2 billion. Now, the profit alone, I'm talking about not the income, the profit of Exxon for last year was $44 billion. It'd be no problem at all for Exxon to run a campaign contribution of $1 billion. So we're about to see even more gunpowder or money behind conservative causes. May I go back to the point you made about the Tea Party, which I think is very important?
Sure.
You see, I think the Tea Party got one point right. This government is really not working for us very often. So their frustration with the government very often is justified. Where we failed, where the liberals and the left failed, is showing them that why the government is not working. That is what's called captured, that it's captured by special interests. And so there is the potential. If we could get the Tea Party to see that the reason the government often is responsive not to people's needs is because it's captured by special interests, then we may be able to direct what I think is a very justifiable political anger
into the right direction.
Sure, and change the argument from this bogus argument of big government being the enemy to an argument over better government. But, of course, the irony is that the Tea Party have been captured by the special interests. that, of course, is... But just in the last few minutes, though, I would like to ask you then about what I think is a more psychological problem here in terms of the disparity between the Republicans who are determined and the Democrats who seem feckless. Every Republican will stand up and say, I'm a proud conservative. It got so crazy, the competition to be the proud conservative amongst the Republicans running for president, that Mitt Romney said, I'm a severe conservative. And how many times have you heard liberals stand up and say, I'm a proud liberal?
Well, you couldn't be more correct. It's in part, of course, again, the fear that the public out there also, when you ask people to identify themselves out there, for every liberal, there are two conservatives. So if you are running for office, you kind of timid. That's one reason people are timid. But there's another reason, and that is we don't have a strong liberal narrative. The other day, a reporter from CNN asked a group of Democratic voters, to summarize the Republican message. And they did very easily, very clearly. And then she asked them to summarize the Democratic message, and they couldn't come up with one. I'm not sure what the liberal message is. And look, I do this 24 hours, most days and most weeks. We need a narrative, and by the way, a uniting narrative, because there are 16 liberal narratives. But, not everybody agrees with Pacifica either.
Sure. So, well, that's the balkanization of the left. I thank you for joining us here. I'm afraid we ran out of time, Amitai Etzioni, but I thank you.
Thanks for having me.
Again, I've been speaking with Amitai Etzioni, who's a university professor of international affairs, and director of the Institute for Communitarian Policy Studies at George Washington University. He served as a senior advisor to the White House from 1979 to 1980, and in 1990, he founded the Communitarian Network, a not-for-profit, nonpartisan organization dedicated to shoring up the moral, social, and political foundations of society. Dr. Etzioni is the author of 24 books, including The New Golden Rule, The Spirit of Community, and The Moral Dimension Towards a New Economics. His most recent books are My Brother's Keeper, A Memoir and a Message, From Empire to Community, A New Approach to International Relations, and How Patriotic is the Patriot Act? He has an article at Salon.com, How Conservatives Still Run America Despite Losing Elections. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon and the assistant producer Nick Guarino. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com, where you can also contact me. And I'll be back again tomorrow at 5 p.m. with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.